Oh, welcome back to Mediocrity episode number 8, where our show is just okay. We're just okay. We're mediocre, as in mediocrity. Oh my goodness, what a week it's been. We're going to have fun today. I'm Brian Kluger. I'm with Boomstick Comics and High Def Digest and the Entertainment Answer on 660 AM K-Sky on Sundays at 9 PM. And I'm joined by the amazing, the incomparable, the fantastical, handsome man, Jonathan Atterbury from New American Fitness, an all-around good musician, art, everything. What up, man?
What is up, man? How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Your week all right?
My week's been good.
You don't have, like, a Star Wars shirt on today.
No, I don't. I don't have sleeves on either.
It's crazy. You know what? You are sleeveless right now. I can see your guns right now.
I had to get sex it up for you, you know?
Oh, my God. I love when you get sexy for me. And usually, in between Jonathan Atterbury and I sits a gentleman named Jeremy Maygert. We talked about him and his new comic book, Primal Instinct, which debuted at the Dallas Comic Show this past weekend. I went to the Dallas Comic Show, saw him there. Actually, the Dallas Morning News newspaper took a picture, not of him, but of his girlfriend Josie sitting at his table. Jeremy was nowhere to be found. Like today, he's nowhere to be found. He has, I think what the doctors call a raging case of pussyfoot.
It's certainly a debilitating case of pussyfoot.
Yeah, a pussyfoot. He can't even put on socks.
I think he was dancing to the newest Lady Gaga track.
Okay.
And he tripped and sprained his ankle.
I mean, that sounds like him.
Yes.
He's missing on such a good show we have today. Our show today is going to consist of... We're going to talk about the original 1978 Superman movie in detail. Give you some trivia, some themes, what it's like, you know, what the movie is like all about and why they really haven't done a good job since then. I mean, there's been some decent ones since then, but the original is so good. We're also going to talk about the Beatles and how their music influenced and changed all of our lives. Maybe some of their solo projects. We'll go there. And then, since our last episode was episode 7, and since we're being mediocre and mediocrity, we forgot all to recast the movie 7. You know, the one with Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman. So we're going to recast that movie 7 if it were remade today, because in this era of Hollywood remakes, we just can't believe there hasn't been a remake of 7 yet. So we're going to recast. We're going to give Hollywood some suggestions of actors to play those roles if it were remade today. So we're going to recast 7 on episode 8. Very excited about this.
Yes.
But we do miss our friend Jeremy Maygert. Hopefully he hobbles in here and surprises us. What are the chances?
Pretty low.
Pretty low. Maybe we can get him to call in. I don't know. But yeah, we're going to have a really good time here. Jonathan, what's the one thing you've done this week that you've really enjoyed?
I put out a couple new articles on the website, so
cool.
I'm pretty stoked on that.
Yeah?
Yeah, the newest one that I just put out was how to eat, or it says, it's just called Eat, Drink, and Lift Like an Amazonian Warrior Queen.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is it more towards the women audience?
It is. Right. The previous one I put out before that was Eat, Drink, and Lift Like a Norse God. So
that's
then I had
right.
to do one for the ladies as well.
So Thor and like Black Widow, or Thor and She-Ra?
Well, you know, it's a little bit more historically influenced, like Hippolyta.
Okay.
Stuff like that, like actual Amazonian queens.
And,
but of course, I had to make reference to Xena. And,
Xena, warrior princess.
The Wonder Woman.
Where can we find these articles at?
These articles are all just on my website, newamericanfitness.net.
Newamericanfitness.net. Go there. It's some pretty cool stuff. He talks about all sorts of nutrition and getting your body, your mind, and your soul right.
Absolutely.
Good shit. I like it. But let's move on. Let's talk about... Let's open up with the Beatles. I mean,
okay.
Beatles are a good opening act,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
They're the best opening act. Did they ever have an opening act?
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure they did probably back in the days when they were playing in the cave and all that.
That's true. So, the Beatles, you have John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, side note, he's my favorite, and Ringo Starr. Before they broke up, they were probably going to have a fifth member, and his name was
Billy Preston.
Billy Preston. There you go.
It was right on the tip of my tongue.
But unfortunately, they broke up. They went solo. But I mean, what was the Beatles' first album? Before we go there, what do you think makes the Beatles like just so world renowned? Like they're just responsible for like our current anything in music, I think.
Well, I think they were such trailblazers. You know what I mean? As far as their sound is concerned, especially once they started getting a little bit more experimental, getting into Revolver, Sgt. Pepper's, things like that, it started to really blaze a whole new trail as far as music was concerned and the fusion of rock and pop and experimental music as well. So I think that combination was what made it timeless. Because there's so many versions of the Beatles. You know, it's not just like the Beatles had one sound.
It's kind of like Stanley Kubrick, how he made a different movie in a different genre of a different time period.
Absolutely.
And Beatles kind of just progressed as...
You, the audience member, grow with them.
Because when they started out, it's very like 1950s-esque sock hop. And then they went into like, you know, Woodstock and, you know, very trippy...
Yeah,
bluesy.
They weren't at Woodstock.
No, they weren't. No, I'm saying in that time vibe. Period. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was Rubber Soul when they first... So their first album was Please Please Me.
Mm-hmm.
That was very much just that rock and roll 50s...
Yeah, the sock hop, you know,
That type of vibe. And then, of course, they started getting more experimental with Rubber Soul. That was where it really changed. Fun little fact, that was also the album that influenced Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys to create his album Pet Sounds.
Which is regarded as one of the best albums ever.
And for anyone that hasn't listened to it, go out and get a copy because it's incredible.
Yes. Yes, it is. Brian Wilson is amazing. And that album is excellent. The Beatles... A lot of people don't realize how fairly difficult their chords are and how, like, just how all over the place it is and how difficult it is to sing in their octaves and play on guitar and piano. There's a lot of really, you know, difficult things in their melodies, I think.
I don't know if I would say that there was anything too difficult vocal-wise or even instrumentally, but what I would say about it was that it was all perfect.
It was all perfect.
It was all exactly what fit for the part.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? None of them were out there shredding. You didn't have anyone trying to be Eddie Van Halen or anything like that. But they were all playing, especially towards the later days, the perfect part for the song. I think that they were all really good about looking at a song as a whole. And figuring out what was needed to complement the song and make it better.
No, I agree. In each album just kind of flows perfectly as if, I don't know, they were like telling a story in a book or something like that.
Yeah.
And they, I can't get enough. I mean, people still listen to the Beatles as if they were basically still playing today, I think, and talk about them like that today. And, you know, we only have two remaining Beatles alive right now.
Yeah.
And one of them just turned 70 and the other one's older than that. And it's interesting to see. I mean, when I say Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr are still alive, Paul McCartney still gets out there and plays for over 3 hours. I've seen him three times.
And he puts on a hell of a show,
too. He does. He plays his Wings. He plays his solo. He plays
Beatles tracks. Yeah.
So it's interesting. What do you, as you say you're a big Beatles fan, what do you look in for Beatles songs? Like, do you tend to go towards, like, the softer songs, or do you like kind of like the trippier or like the rockier versions?
I like all of it, to be honest. There's very few Beatles songs that I don't like. And I think the ones I don't like are the real apex of the trippiness. If we're talking like Piggies on the White Album or something like that, that's the stuff where it loses me because it becomes much less musical, much more just about sound experimentation.
Right.
Which I get. They were blazing trails and I respect it, but it's not something I'm going to listen to when I'm hanging out, you know?
Yeah.
But I think I don't know. It's hard to say. I love it all. It's all got a special place for me.
What would you say? Well, I mean, I guess if you had to take three Beatles songs to listen to forever and nothing else, what would they be?
Well, I think Tomorrow Never Knows is mm-hmm. going to be really high on that list.
Okay.
Which was the closing track of Revolver.
Uh-huh.
That's the one where you had John Lennon's influence by John Lennon's lyrics were influenced by the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Yes,
and he had a lot of fun. George Martin had a lot of fun producing that track, and it's just a very interesting song. And it's fun. It's really cool to listen to.
Yeah,
I also love the song "Babies in Black."
Uh huh.
I think that's off of Beatles for Sale.
Okay,
and that's just a great example of, in my opinion, the harmonies between Lennon and McCartney. They're both singing throughout the whole song. You get a lot of passion, a lot of fun. It's just a great track.
It is.
And I also love, I think, If I Fell is one, you know, just because we're getting a little bit of everything here. We've
yeah.
got kind of the classic rock harmony thing, a little trippier with Tomorrow Never Knows. And then If I Fell, I think, is just a really good example of excellent songwriting
okay.
on their parts.
So those are those three. Can you play those on guitar or sing those?
I can play Babies in Black. I can sing all of them.
Uh-huh.
I could probably learn the other two, but I don't think I've ever taken the time to.
No? Okay. And with the Beatles, so in modern music today, you don't, the Beatles really just, in interviews, they weren't really, with how they dressed. I mean, yeah, you could go to the Sgt. Pepper's and how they dressed, but they were all about the music, and they drew their influences from a wide variety of world music. You know, George Harrison went to India and met Ravi Shankar. And
They all did.
Yeah. And there were albums just like that, or how you just mentioned John Lennon. And they don't do that in modern music, I don't think. It's just all too bubblegum sugar-coated nowadays, and they don't really take the time to really actually, I think, study music. Or
I think that the problem nowadays is that a lot of the pop artists all sound the same, because we've got usually a lot of the pop artists are all being written for by the same small group of people.
Right.
You know, there's a handful of songwriters that are really successful pop songwriters that are writing the tracks for everybody that you're hearing on the radio now.
Yeah.
Now, it's not to say there are not original artists now, because there are. And there are very educated musicians. I mean, a good band like Lake Street Dive, for example.
Amazing, amazing band.
Yes, and they all met at a music conservatory, so uh-huh. they're highly educated musicians. And there's certainly original music to be found. It's just, you know, the pop music is
yeah.
totally vanilla. And it's whitewashed because everyone's got auto-tuning, so then everyone sounds the same.
Yeah.
Because the auto-tuning is great in that it makes everyone hit the right notes, but the problem is it sucks all the uniqueness out of a person's voice.
Right.
So they all end up sounding like the same person.
Which is awful. And that's what you like about the Beatles, because they each had like a distinct sound, and they each played a unique instrument really well.
And they each wrote in a unique way as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, because you can, you know, like, well, Ringo Starr wrote "With a Little Help from My Friends," right? That was his song, right?
I don't think he wrote that.
I thought that was his song,
He sang it,
okay.
But he didn't write it.
Okay, he didn't write it.
As far as I know, I think that was a Paul McCartney song.
Okay. And did he do "Love, Love Me Do," or did he sing that?
He did not sing that.
I'm trying to remember if he did, because I know he played that as live
"Love
shows.
Me Do" is Lennon and McCartney singing.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. So I know Ringo does that. And then, you know, one thing that if you ever see Paul McCartney, or if you think the Beatles, one of the most popular ones is probably "Hey Jude," right? But that's
yeah.
it's kind of like a stadium, you know, everybody sings together sort of thing.
Yeah.
Do you think that's some of their best stuff, or do you think kind of like maybe "My Guitar Gently Weep"? Not. I'm sorry. "Why Don't We Do It in the Road" or "Blackbird" is more of their niche or their best stuff? Or do you think it's more like "Twist and Shout" or "Hey Jude"? Or
it's hard to say, because there's a difference. I mean, if we're talking early Beatles stuff,
mm-hmm.
there's a unique perfection to that stuff, and that had this incredible energy. if you listen to A Hard Day's Night or With the Beatles or anything like that, it's just got a wonderful, joyful energy, and it's very youthful. It's like listening to early Bruce Springsteen or something like that, and it's just got this youthful, explosive energy that can't help but make you feel happy when you listen to it.
Yeah, it's like that. It's upbeat. It's, you know, I think mostly about, you know, teenagers getting together,
yeah,
you know,
and
stuff
it's just
like that,
well,
yeah,
executed. So it's, yeah, fun, and it's uplifting music. Now, if you listen to something like Abbey Road, uh-huh, now Abbey Road, I think, was probably the apex of their creativity.
That was that their last album?
Yes.
Yeah.
That was their last album. I think, I can't remember. There's some kind of, was Let It Be or Abbey Road released last?
Oh, that's a good question.
Because I think that Abbey Road was released last,
uh-huh,
but it was actually recorded before,
correct,
they recorded Let It Be. And
yes.
Then, so that's how that worked out.
Right, right.
Let It Be is just a bummer of an album, in my opinion.
It's, well, it's sad.
It is, and you can tell that, you know, especially from what I understand about that project, Paul was really pushing to keep it together.
Mm-hmm.
He was really fighting to let it be like, hey, let's go back and let's capture some of the youthful energy from our earlier albums. And there are some really great moments on the Let It Be album, but it's the one Beatles album where I don't want to just sit and listen to it from front to back.
Because, you know, they were no longer after that.
And there, not only were they no longer, but there was, you can tell that even though Paul was working his ass off to make it work,
mm-hmm,
you can tell that the rest of the members probably, there was no longer that emotional involvement in it. They were giving it half energy.
Yeah, because they were all trying to do their own thing. I mean, Lennon and Yoko were trying to do their experimental stuff. Then you had George Harrison, you know,
he just
doing,
didn't care anymore.
Yeah, well, he was doing the world music, and then he started doing his solo, and then in the 80s he did, you know, like Gossip, and
right.
I mean, that's where he went, and then Ringo just, I feel like, he did his solo stuff, but he just kind of like hung out. Ringo just kind of,
I think that's the vibe that we definitely all get from Ringo, is forever just hanging out.
Yeah, he's just there, just hanging out. He was the older one. But yeah, their music is just iconic, and it's weird because since we talk about movies on mediocrity, their music is always super expensive to purchase in movies. Like,
yeah,
that's why you don't rarely hear it. And if they do, that's the budget of the movie, basically. It's like $2 million or more for a song.
It's true. I mean, it's really rare. I think the one exception I can think of is Across the Universe.
And, well, because they had all the Beatles,
they were
states,
all involved.
Yeah,
in
were
that,
all involved. So
that was a really cool project, and I liked that movie a lot. But they had that big deal recently because for the longest time you couldn't get the Beatles music on iTunes,
yeah,
or anything like that. And so they just, what it was, a year ago or something like that, just released it all on the internet.
They finally did, and then they released the CDs in mono and stereo,
yeah,
as well as the records. And they're not cheap.
No,
I mean, we're
it's
talking
expensive.
Several hundred dollars for those sets.
I mean, but worth it.
Yeah, because you get all the albums. You get all the, you know, stuff that was on all the compilations and everything. I do have to say that Beatles do sound awesome on vinyl. Like, when I used to have people over to... When I still have people over to... When people say that, oh, MP3 is just fine, it sounds just as good, and I was like, no, I always play Goodbye, Hello, Hello, Goodbye for the Beatles. You say goodbye.
Oh, yeah.
I say hello. I play that on MP3 on the same speakers, and I play the record version on vinyl.
Now, MP3, no doubt. I think anyone that says MP3 is the same as vinyl is just misled.
That's why I don't think they know. And
yeah,
so when I play it for them, they see an immediate difference.
Yeah.
And a lot of the times they go buy vinyl or a record player because you get the lows, you get the highs. It's not compressed. It's...
Yeah, there's a huge compression on MP3s. Now, CDs are a different story. CDs, what do you think? Do you think there's a huge difference if you get, like, the new Beatles mono CD versus the new Beatles mono vinyl? Do you think there's a difference there?
I do think there is a difference there, but it's smaller. However, with something on vinyl, you still get kind of the crackling, which I like, and I think it's just a fuller sound, that analog fuller sound.
The analog, I think the only time you can really tell the difference between a good CD and a good vinyl is if you have, like, the absolute top of the end speakers and the whole setup.
Uh-huh.
Because it's such a minute difference, you have to really be an audiophile to care
about
that.
But it's there, though.
It is there.
It
I agree.
It is there.
Yeah. Now, what's your favorite Beatles album?
My favorite Beatles album? Oh, my gosh. Probably Revolver.
Revolver is a damn good album.
It is a damn good album. That, I mean, I have an original of that, and it's so good. I just, and it, I don't know, I, for that, I mean, but to me, I like so much of the Beatles. Like, I can do Twist and Shout, or I can do Let It Be, you know, all day long.
Right.
Or I can do, I love Why Don't We Do It in the Road.
That's a great track.
I love Helter Skelter so much. I love Lucy in the Sky. Blackbird is a beautiful song.
So you like a lot of the White Album stuff.
I mean, I do like a lot of the White Album stuff, but... and then Yesterday and Today is a great album. Like, you know, Paper, not that it's on there, but like, I love Paperback Writer. I love We Can Work It Out. You know, it's just, I think they're just listening to them for so long. And so, because I was introduced to them when I was, you know, 4 or 5
yes,
with my parents. And it just, it grew on me. And then I started learning the meaning behind the songs. And it just, it still stays with you. And I still like when I listen to new music today, which there is good music today that just never compares to these guys, because they do all play their own instruments. They all know how to play several instruments. They know music theory and...
And George Martin was just one of the best producers of all time.
You don't get that nowadays. Now it's like, what can go viral? What do I wear? What makeup do I put on?
Yeah,
you know?
it's much more cookie cutter.
Which sucks, because there could be good music...
And there is, but the good music so frequently is just swept under the rug, and it doesn't get the airtime that it deserves.
Right, right.
Now, I just thought of one other really good usage of a Beatles song in a television show, actually.
Oh, this is Fred Savage, right?
No.
It's not?
No. This is Mad Men.
Oh.
There was an episode of Mad Men.
That's right, there was.
I forget the name of Don Draper's wife, but his French wife.
Yes.
She came home one day and was like, here, here's this new album. She handed him a copy of Revolver.
Yeah.
And he throws on Tomorrow Never Knows. And it's this great scene. And he ends up just turning it off because he doesn't dig it.
Yeah. I absolutely remember that. And I remember watching that episode live and saying, how much did they pay for that?
They must have. Oh, you know, another thing they did is there was another episode where Roger Sterling is taking LSD and he listens to Pet Sounds.
Yes.
Which we were talking about earlier.
Absolutely. And there was one where they were at the Rolling Stones as well. Like,
yeah.
They were trying to get Rolling Stones to sign on or something like that. But yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It's a great show. I mean, I love that show.
It's rare that happens. Yeah. I mean, in Mad Men, that was later on in the seasons and they were making millions of dollars.
But I think in the first season, at the last episode of the first season, they even had Bob Dylan's song on there.
Yeah.
So they were, you know, putting up some serious cash for soundtracking.
But a lot of the movies or music you see now, there might be a Beatles song, but it is sung by somebody else.
That's more common, more common.
So like in the Royal Tenenbaums, where you hear Hey Jude at, you know, the opening, but that's, I mean, that's not the Beatles,
right.
But it's somebody else singing. And even when we mentioned the opening of the Fred Savage show, why am I blinking on it?
The Wonder Years.
With a little help from my friends, that was a Beatles song, but maybe even done better by Joe Cocker.
Wasn't that one actually not the Joe Cocker version?
In the original show, it was. On the Netflix, it was. On Netflix, it wasn't.
They changed
it, yeah.
So on Netflix now, it's a cover of Joe Cocker's cover.
Correct.
With a little help from my friends.
Yes, because they could not... Because there were like two Beatles songs in the original show that they had. And those two Beatles songs are still there, but they're not by the Beatles. They're covers.
Gotcha.
And then the song on Netflix sounds comparable.
It's close, but
yes.
It's not Joe Cocker.
Correct.
I mean,
it's
really.
Not. But
nobody's Joe Cocker.
Correct, because Joe Cocker is one of those people that pretty much made the original songs better, which is very hard to do,
yeah.
Even when you're doing with the Beatles.
And he was doing it at the same time as
yeah.
The Beatles, which takes balls.
Correct. Yes, it does. And he made it better. But yeah, that's our... We've talked for over 20 minutes about Beatles. We got to move on.
We could just go on forever.
We really could. But if... We know you know the Beatles. Just please, if you listen to this, put on a Beatles record, put on some Beatles songs, and just really immerse yourself into that.
And let us know what some of your favorite Beatles songs are.
Yeah, yeah. We'll post your answers. Follow us on Facebook at @media_ocrity or @mediaocrity. Post them on there. Let us know what your favorite songs are. Let's move on to... Dun, da, da, da. It's a bird. It's a plane. No, it's Superman. Oh my God, Superman. He has been around a long time.
OMG, Superman.
OMG, zombie. Oh my God, barbecue pizza, Superman. Or Kal-El, as some people would like to call him.
That's my dog's name.
Kal-El. That's mm-hmm. You like Superman. I like Superman too. We have in front of us right now a Blu-ray that came out a few years ago from Warner Brothers. It's the Superman Motion Picture Collection Anthology. And this does not include Man of Steel. This includes the Superman movies up until or right after the Brand Ruth one with Kevin Spacey as Lex Luthor.
So it does have the Richard Pryor one, Superman
it 3, absolutely,
right?
It does. Which we're only going to talk about the first Superman, but with that one, with the Richard Pryor one, there was really one cool scene in that movie where it was Bizarro Superman fighting the real Superman. That was in a junkyard. It was really cool. But let's go to the original Superman, which came out in 1978. Now, Superman had already been around for, 40 years? Action Comics number one.
Quite a while.
And they did TV shows about him. They did cartoons about him. But nobody really did a big, big movie about him. And who else to do the movie, direct the movie at least, Richard Donner.
Who is a national treasure.
Who went on to direct The Goonies.
And Lethal Weapon.
Lethal Weapon.
Just some great stuff.
Yeah, so he directed Superman. And the movie back in 1978 was made for only $55 million.
Now, pittance.
Yeah, that's like an indie film nowadays. I mean, latest Justice League.
What a goddamn
League,
fortune back then.
Yeah, Batman v Superman probably cost $230 million to make, and it was terrible. but, I mean, the original Superman, it made over $300 million. And you know who wrote that original Superman?
Maybe it's not ringing a bell right now, though.
Mario Puzo.
Oh, Godfather.
Godfather.
Wow.
Hints. Who's in Superman that was also in Godfather?
I don't know.
Don Corleone.
Oh, Marlon Brando.
Marlon
That's right,
Brando.
Yeah. As,
There's
Jor-El.
A connection there,
I
absolutely.
Forgot that. Yeah.
So yeah, Mario Puzo, you have a script by the guy who wrote Godfather, and you have Richard Donner, the director, who, you know, at the time, he was still known. He's an excellent director, but he went on to do a ton of other things. You have John Williams doing the music, which
and it's
is
really
iconic.
One of the greatest scores of film, in my opinion. Just such a good score.
Yeah. And so in 1978, Warner Brothers, they got the rights and they started planning it in 1973. So it took about 5 years to come out. And I went and I did some research on who the studio wanted to direct and star as Superman.
Okay.
It's insane to me what studio people think sometimes. So we'll start with directors first. So they talked about Francis Ford Coppola, which is fine when that makes sense.
Yeah, that would have been good.
Mario Puzo, Godfather thing. They also talked about William Friedkin, who directed before that
Exorcist.
And they also talked about Sam Peckinpah, which... very gritty, violent westerns. He's a great director, but Spielberg was mentioned, but he was coming off of Jaws and all that stuff, and they fell through. However, Richard Donner got the job. But now I'm even reading my list of the actors they wanted, and I laugh my ass off because it's so crazy. It's so crazy. I'm going to give you a list of people that the studio wanted.
Okay, let's hear it.
Muhammad Ali, Al Pacino, James Caan, Clint Eastwood, and Dustin Hoffman. These were names that were brought up to play Superman.
I'm really sad that Muhammad Ali was not cast as Superman.
You are, huh?
Because I would like to see that movie.
So, other people they thought for Superman... was who they wanted for Superman was Nick Nolte, Christopher
okay.
Walken, and I shit you not, Neil Diamond.
Neil Diamond.
Neil Diamond.
As Superman.
As Superman. We're coming to America today. And I just can't get over these things. I mean, I actually also think Sylvester Stallone was thought to be, or they asked him to be Superman as well.
They were just asking everybody. Like, Richard Dreyfuss, will you be Superman?
It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. But they landed on Christopher Reeve, and it really was the perfect choice because he really wasn't known. But he... Just to give you an example, doing more research, the movie studio wanted Christopher Reeve to wear a bodysuit, and he absolutely refused to. Instead, he spent several months hardcore training and working out with David Prowse, who was the guy in the Darth Vader thing, to beef up like he was.
Yeah.
He literally refused to wear a bodysuit. He's like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do it right.
And there's a great story about when he went into audition for the part. Because Christopher Reeve was just like a college kid, athletic. But he looked like a tennis player or something like that.
Right.
He was lean, but he wasn't overweight or anything. But he just didn't have much muscle about
him.
He said he came in and literally just like put on the thickest sweater that he had.
Yeah.
Trying to look a little bit bigger. And David Prowse did a great... Is it Prowse or Prowse?
Is it Prowse?
I think it's Prowse.
David Prowse? Yeah.
And they did a great job because he looks really good in that movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's not anywhere like what you would see nowadays compared to Henry Cavill or Chris Hemsworth. But this was... Like, Chris Reeve was not on steroids.
Yeah. Exactly.
He, like, did a really good job of naturally changing his physique in a relatively short amount of time.
And what do you... Because you do the fitness. What do you think? What do you... How he did that?
Oh, I think that it was just from what I've researched about this, because it's something I've looked up to say, wow, how did he make such a great transformation naturally in a short amount of time? And the truth is it was just working out every day. I mean, he ate a bunch of food, good food, not just junk food. He was eating a bunch of wholesome food, and he was working out with weights almost every day.
And that shows you how amazing Christopher Reeve was as a person and as an actor. Like, I can't imagine Dustin Hoffman or Clint Eastwood refusing to do the bodysuit. Christopher Reeve literally became Superman.
And, you know, in my opinion, Christopher Reeve is the best Superman to have ever hopped in the suit.
I agree, because he has that quality that you want to love him. Like, he's funny and he doesn't really know it.
He's innocent, like, and charming.
Yeah,
and
he really is. And you know what? And it's unfortunate because Henry Cavill can have that in the new Man of Steel and the new DC, but they're going so dark with it that he's just always brooding and angry, and you don't get that. And even with, like, not the revamp, but it's more of a sequel with, you know, Kevin Spacey and Brandon Routh, there was that aspect there.
Yeah, Routh had a really good vibe also. He did a great job.
Yeah, but it wasn't a great movie.
Bad movie, great. And Kevin Spacey, though, I mean...
He was good.
He was perfect Lex Luthor. I wish that he was still Lex Luthor.
That would be... Yeah, I agree. I've seen Jesse Eisenberg. But yeah, there's... That first movie, because... Let's get into that. What I think worked about that first movie so well is that it was basically divided into like three separate films. You have the first part of the film, which took place on Krypton, which was very sci-fi-esque. You had kind of like where everything was coming from. And then, you know, Superman gets sent away after the planet is destroyed and everything's destroyed. And he goes to Smallville where he sees, you know, he has Ma and Pa Kent, which plays out kind of like, you know, one of those pre-nuclear 1950s era, you know, movies where it's like everything's happy and you get to see a young Clark Kent lift a bus. And
jumping around.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. But it's like very 1950s. And then you get to the meat of the story where it's Clark Kent and Superman in Metropolis or New York. And it's like the realism of bringing this superhero to the real life. And I think it's such a perfect transition of how his character became an alien to growing up as, you know, partly in a human existence to wanting to save and be with the humans.
Right.
It's really cool.
I agree. And, you know, I think one of the reasons the original Superman movie worked so well is the same reason I think that the first two Tim Burton Batman movies worked so well, in that they're whimsical. I think that they were taking it less seriously, mm-hmm. and it was more just about having fun with it.
Or there's the comic in the comic.
Exactly. Yeah. It's more fantastical. It's way different than the kind of comic book movies that we're getting nowadays, especially from DC.
Correct.
And I tend to... DC strikes me as being cheesier. You know what I mean? I know that a lot of the comic books... I was being educated by my friend Carson because she was really mad at me that I had some beef to say about DC in our sixth episode. But so a lot of their stuff is darker in the comic books, but... And the movie's been trying to find that lately, but they can't seem to find the balance between being dark and still wanting to be lighter and cheesy, almost more like the Marvel stuff.
Right.
They can't find a home lately. But these earlier movies, Superman and Batman with Tim Burton, they were just cheesier.
They were.
And they had great soundtracks, and they were fun, and they were just less serious. And I think that kind of DC film works so much better for me.
Well, and I also think they spend more time, you know, nothing's nailed on the head like they are nowadays, as of with this first Superman film. Like, you really feel the tension between Lex, you know, Gene Hackman, and Christopher Reeve. You yeah. really love Lois Lane, even though she doesn't do much in the movie.
And that was Margot Kidder, right?
Correct. Right. I mean, she's still the damsel in distress, but...
likeable.
Yeah, they're very likable, and their relationship is organically done, and...
I think that this movie and the Batman movies, there's a lot of correlation between those, and that they really weren't action movies.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was more just... about having... It's like a fun fantasy movie almost.
Yeah, it wasn't... Like I said, it was... In the original one, you didn't have all of the cityscape fall down.
It wasn't CG.
Like I said, there was sci-fi. There was the 50s where you just saw like almost like an indie film.
Right.
And then you had, you know, some pretty decent effects. But, I mean, it was nominated... for 3 Academy Awards, Superman 1 was.
And it just had the right... You know, since they couldn't lean back like so many movies do nowadays on just having incredible sets and explosions and CGI and fancy camera work, back then it was just like, we have to write a good story.
Right.
If we want this movie to be good, it has to be written well and performed well. And these movies did that. They had so many it was about the characters.
Yeah.
And I think when you have the depth of character, that works a lot better. When you can look at... Superman or Lois Lane or even Gene Hackman's Lex Luthor and just get the sense of humanity from that feels better that way.
I absolutely agree. I mean, every time I watch Superman 1, I just can't stop it. I have to finish it. And yeah. You're just like, man, that's such a good film. Why can't they do that today? Why does everything have to be so dark and brooding and on an epic scale where the whole world collapses or there's like a big butthole in the sky that sucks everything up, you know? It's like in every movie these days. I don't get it.
Buttholes everywhere.
Buttholes everywhere.
Sky buttholes.
Sky buttholes. That's why, I mean, I love the original Superman. And I think if you have a chance, you should go back and rewatch it and, you know, put yourself in that time, you know, it's so good. Those characters are so good. That soundtrack is so good. I mean, it's iconic.
It is.
Da, 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 da.
Bumpada, bumpada, bumpada.
Yeah, it gets you pumped up. It's so good. And then, of course, they made several sequels. We'll get to those another time. We could do a podcast show on each Superman movie, and we will. We can get back maybe in the next couple weeks with Superman 2, the theatrical, and the Donner Cut, which, hey, I prefer the Donner Cut. But that's me. But yeah, Superman 1, that is... Do you have anything else to say about Superman?
No, just go watch it. If you haven't seen it, you're totally selling yourself short here. You're do yourself a favor and go watch it because it's a wonderful movie. If you like The Goonies, Lethal Weapon, it's got that same charm that those movies
have. Yeah, you have the director of The Goonies and Lethal Weapon. You have the writer of The Godfather in there. You have Marlon Brando in the movie.
And John Williams does the score. What more can you ask for?
Exactly.
Really?
It is so good. So... there's our Superman segment. And then, which brings us to...
Finally. We're finally going to do it.
I think Atterbury, Jonathan, Atterbury, Jonathan. is very excited about this. He had this idea. Well, first, we on an old podcast of mine, we used to recast a bunch of movies. And Jonathan wanted to recast this one. We've never done it, and it sounds so much fun. We were supposed to do it on our 7th podcast, but we all forgot because we're all mediocre. Because we're mediocrity. Where can they find us on social media?
Instagram is media_ocrity. Twitter is the same. And okay. Facebook is just media_ocrity.
Awesome. So we're going to recast the movie 7, S-E, the number 7, E-N. If you remember that, I have some notes about that in my book right here, because before we get into it, I always like to give you a little bit of background. So, who directed 7?
David Fincher.
There you go. Brad Pitt, David Fincher, been together forever. They did, what did they do? They did 7, they did Fight Club. They did Benjamin Button, and now, as of yesterday, I think that Brad Pitt wants David Fincher to come on and do World War Z Part 2.
Gotcha.
They're good together. So, 7 came out September 22nd, 1995. How old were you?
I was 9.
You were 9, so I was 14.
I was not allowed to see that movie when it came out.
That movie cost $33 million to make. And this is a fairly rated R movie.
I'd say it's a strong R.
Strong R.
Yeah.
It made over $328 million. And I will say, if you've seen the movie, it stars Morgan Freeman as Detective Somerset, the older,
wiser
detective. And it starred Brad Pitt as a younger rookie Detective Mills. And I would like to say that the studio also had different people in mind for
Mills and Somerset.
Let's hear what
the studio had ideas, because we got some other stuff.
Correct. So for Somerset, these two people turned it down before they went to Morgan Freeman. They wanted William Hurt, and they wanted Al Pacino.
Both for Somerset.
Down. Correct. And then the next two people turned down the role of Detective Mills, which was played by Brad Pitt. Denzel Washington and Sylvester Stallone.
Interesting.
Very weird.
Stallone would have been a really weird choice.
Absolutely.
I could see Denzel just killing it. He would have been great.
Yeah.
But Stallone, Stallone's a great actor, but
in 1995,
weird.
You gotta imagine Stallone was doing like those.
Like
those
Judge
action,
Dredd and stuff.
Judge
like
Dredd and like Daylight and the Bomb movies, you know. It's just, he was on top.
Cliffhanger.
Correct, Cliffhanger. So he was on top of everything. And this
but he was way older, too.
But you know what? Like, he did Copland. He did all those stuff. And I think this would have been a cool movie. But, you know, it would have been weird to see Sylvester Stallone go, yeah, I am the Lord.
Who was in the box?
Who was in the box?
Oh, that's a really bad Sylvester Stallone impression.
So what was it? That's like John Travolta.
Hey, it was in the box.
But speaking of the head in the box scene, spoiler alert. I mean, it's no spoiler. It's been out for more than 20 years.
Yeah.
At the very end, Detective Mills gets his wife's head in a box. You know, literally
he
mailed
him. He doesn't get it in a box.
Yeah, it's cut.
It's cut off by the villain and yeah, placed in a box.
It placed in a box and mailed to him in the middle of nowhere. So originally, the studio and this told the writers to rewrite that scene.
Yeah, but
and
Fincher saw the unedited version, right?
Fincher, they accidentally sent him the first draft of the script, and he loved it, and they went with that. But that wasn't supposed
happy
to...
Happy accident.
Yeah, happy accident, because that's one of, like, the crazier moments.
That movie solidifies... That scene solidifies the whole movie in your mind. It's like the finishing glue.
Well, it's such a scary movie in that when John Doe does turn himself in and he
the
starts
villain.
Talking. Yeah, the villain.
Portrayed by?
It's Kevin Spacey.
The amazing Kevin Spacey.
The amazing Kevin Spacey. You really think the world is going to end or aliens are going to come or something. It's just so nuts. Like, because the tension, the music is so built up and they don't give you any shred of evidence of what's going to happen, really. I mean, when you go back and watch it, there's a couple lines that Brad Pitt talks about when they're, you know, putting the wires on them about their wife or whatever, mm-hmm. about his wife. But you really, that's the world, he's going to bomb everybody. I don't know. It's crazy, but
very well written. I actually read an interesting little tidbit about who wrote this movie. And it was apparently a guy who had gone to film school.
Correct.
And he had essentially given up on his dreams. He was working at Tower Records in New York City. Mm-hmm. And he wrote this script because he was depressed. And so he wrote this really dark script and sent it off to some big director. I don't remember who. But the director didn't want to direct it. But he helped him get it to David Fincher and all that stuff. I thought that was a cool story.
It's a very cool story, and it is such a good movie. And in an era that we're in where Hollywood is remaking everything, and this movie being over 21 years old, we're surprised we haven't seen a remake
yet.
They
could remake it, and it could be awesome.
They could. Do we really want a remake? No.
Yeah.
But if Hollywood, if you're listening to this mediocrity podcast...
We got some ideas.
We've got some ideas. So let's start. Who are we starting with? Do you want to start with the police captain who was played by Arlie Ermey?
Oh, are we doing? I thought we were just doing the four main characters.
Four main characters. That's John Doe, that's Tracy, Mills, and Somerset, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Because Arlie Ermey could still play Arlie Ermey.
He could. He could. So I guess we'll go with Tracy first.
Okay.
The wife who was played by Gwyneth Paltrow.
Uh-huh.
She had a really emotional scene with Somerset in the movie. And about having kids and spoiling them, and you know, she was in the movie. She really, her character in the movie didn't seem like she wanted to move to the big city life like that. And she left all of her friends, and she's home all the time alone. It's crazy. So, who did you have play Tracy?
I want to see Jennifer Lawrence.
Jennifer, oh, see, I can't do it.
You can't do it?
I can't do Jennifer Lawrence.
I just feel like she's got a good, innocent vibe about her.
I mean, I guess her head will be cut off.
Yeah, there you go. I think that for the character of just being an innocent character, small-town girl in a big city, not really liking the environment that she's stuck in, feeling lonesome, all these things, and then the horror that you would experience in watching what happens to her, I feel like Jennifer Lawrence would be a good cast for that.
Okay. All right. I mean... There's just so much of her right now.
There's
I don't know.
Too much of her right now, but I do think that she would do well in the part.
Okay.
Especially because she's kind of like one of the sweethearts right now of America. And I think that that would add to the shock of her being decapitated.
Indeed, sir.
And who did you cast?
Excuse me. I went with Kerry Washington, who... You probably mostly recognize. She was Jamie Foxx's wife in Django Unchained.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Her.
I liked her.
I went with her. I think she is an excellent actress. And I think she would really play that lunch scene in the original so well with that emotion. Because I've seen it. And I think that would be really cool to see her do that. I would go with Kerry Washington. What do you think?
I'm going to stick with... This is going to be really hard. We don't have any kind of tiebreaker.
No, we don't. I'm sticking with Kerry Washington. He's sticking with Jennifer Lawrence. You got to let us know, our audience.
You can be the tiebreakers.
You could be the tiebreakers. All right. I guess we'll go with John Doe then, who was originally played by Kevin Spacey. His name is John Doe in the movie, and he was a brilliant yet... sadistic, villainous character, played by Kevin Spacey very well. I went, which I think would be awesome. I picked this person because I just want him to play this type of role, and I think he could be so good, but he like never plays this role, ever. Tom Hanks.
Tom
Hanks.
That's a really interesting choice.
Because Tom Hanks has range.
He does,
If
no
you
doubt.
Don't know... He has range, and he very rarely plays like a sadistic person. Like in the movie Road to Perdition, he's a bad guy, but he's also kind of like the protagonist in the movie. Mm-hmm. But he's a bad guy, and I think here, to see him sit in that back of that cop car, you know, talking to those two guys, the two detectives, would be incredible.
I agree.
How creepy and sadistic he could pull that off on why he's doing what he's doing. Oh, it'd be so cool. And plus, I mean, he would only have to spend only a few days filming because he's really not in the movie a whole lot.
Right.
So...
A small investment for the man.
So it would be something different for him. He's not the lovable comedy guy who saves the day.
Yeah.
Like, Captain Sully, you know, that he's coming out in
Joe versus the volcano.
So yeah. What do you think? Who do you have?
All right, I chose this actor because I wanted somebody that was a combination of being wickedly, like, sick, right? Mm-hmm. But also has that kind of almost Lex Luthor capacity for being, like, a mad genius. You know what I mean? Someone who is powerful in their mind. And all, but not super physically imposing. You wouldn't look at this person and be like, oh my God, that's a villain, right? I chose Michael Fassbender.
Oh, okay.
Because the role that he played in Prometheus, I forget the character's name.
He's
David,
the droid, yeah.
Yeah. I could see that it's just some slight modifications to that that character that he played working really well for this movie.
That would be really cool.
Because it's almost like that detached kind of robotic thing, but also being incredibly intelligent and dangerous.
That would be really cool.
I could see that being pretty sweet.
Michael Fassbender. It's younger, definitely, than Tom Hanks, but that's why I think Tom Hanks would be cooler, because he's older and he's just kind of starting this now.
Yeah.
I don't know. That would be really cool to me.
They're both... I could see Tom Hanks. Like, I really like Tom Hanks, too. Damn it.
Damn it. It would be really cool. Tom Hanks, if you're listening, we want you to make this. Get it happen to you.
We assume that you are.
Yeah, we assume that Tom Hanks is listening to this. That would be really cool. All right, moving on. Are we doing Mills or Somerset first?
Let's end with Somerset.
Okay. So Detective Mills, Brad Pitt, the young one. I went with another young actor who's excellent now, Michael B. Jordan, who was in Creed. He was Apollo Creed's son, Adonis. He was in the horrible Fantastic Four movie, but he was also in Fruitvale Station. He was in The Wire when he was younger. He's an excellent actor, and it would be cool to see him as, like, this rookie cop, you know, kind of think he knows all of his shit, and he really doesn't, and really face first and, like, the worst of it.
Right.
And I think he would play that part very well, and I think he will play the part with this detective who I have.
Yeah.
Later
on. All right, I'm interested to see who you got.
Okay, so who do you have for Mills?
I'm going with Daniel Radcliffe.
Oh, so I thought about Daniel Radcliffe.
Oh, really?
He's so good. Yes, he is.
He's so good. And I think that because everyone automatically sees Harry Potter when they look at him, you're immediately going to care about this character, right?
Yeah.
Because we all love Daniel Radcliffe. And we're immediately going to have emotional investment there. So seeing him put in harm's way, seeing all the awful stresses and things that he gets exposed to, I feel like it being Daniel Radcliffe would really – not only could Daniel Radcliffe do a great job of the acting – and he's the right age and the right kind of – I think he could just do a great job in that role.
Right.
And the audience would have that immediate attachment to him.
Yeah. No, that's good. It's hard to see him play – I mean, you think of Harry Potter, but – the stuff he's done recently is so good that he's gotten out of the Harry Potter thing for me.
Horns was amazing.
Horns was good. And his recent one, Swiss Army Man, was fantastic. And this upcoming one he's in, where he's like the undercover Nazi guy, where he has a shaved head.
That looks really cool.
He looks so good in that. Both of those are really good.
This is why we need a tiebreaker.
That's why we need a tiebreaker. Jeremy Maggart, again, is suffering from pussyfoot. And he's not here.
Nope.
Damn it. All right.
I think he's having a Gilmore Girls marathon at home.
Hey, I'll be the first to admit it. I've watched Gilmore Girls TV show all the way through at least 5 times. I'm a huge Gilmore Girls fan. Huge.
I've never watched one episode.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you this right now on this podcast, and you're going to have to come back at some point and tell me. All of the Gilmore Girls episodes are on Netflix.
Okay.
You seriously need to sit down and watch them.
All of them.
Seriously, you won't be able to stop. They're that good. And
sister is a major. She's been trying for a long time.
No, so I love it because it's some of the best written stuff. And if you love pop culture, you love music, you love movies, it's riddled with references like that. So there's like nothing ever really at stake in the show like there would be in Lost or Walking Dead or Breaking Bad. Mm-hmm. It's like good people in a good town, and the characters are so amazing.
Okay.
Trust me, it's not like Pretty Little Liars or Vampire Diaries or anything like that. It's one of the smartest shows ever made, and I love good shows, and I didn't think I'd ever like Gilmore Girls. It's one of the best shows. It's in my top probably five of all time.
All right. Well, Brian's been ranting about Gilmore Girls for 5 minutes now.
I'm sorry. In our middle of our seven recast, I'm sorry.
We found out
I'm
that Brian sorry. Is a big fan of the Gilmore
I'm
Girls.
I'm a big fan of the Gilmore Girls and Human Centipede, so go figure.
And Salo.
And Salo. But moving on to our
back on track.
Okay, back on track. To Detective Somerset, who was played brilliantly by 21-year younger Morgan Freeman, who could throw a knife at the bullseye of a dartboard every now and then, and just calm, cool, collected, knew his stuff.
Sage-like, one might say.
Yeah, so in this script, if they're going to keep with this, you know, have like the older, wiser, calmer guy to the younger, rookie kind of...
Hothead.
To my Michael B. Jordan... I think, again, this is a great character actor who could play an older guy really well. Robert Downey Jr.
Oh, you know what? I thought about him.
Really?
For this role. I did.
Robert Downey Jr. to play just like who's seen it all. He's rugged and just like he's done with it. And he's just this last thing he does not want to be on it. But the captain who played by Arlie Ermey, who I actually recasted as Sam Jackson.
I want to talk to you about the Avengers initiative.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, this movie 7.
It forces Robert Downey Jr. to take control of this because Michael B. Jordan can't, you know, he's a hothead, he can't do it.
I think that could be awesome. I love that idea.
And that would be awesome to see because usually you see Robert Downey Jr. in kind of like a funnier role or you know, more of a serious role, but he has that humor to him. But he,
yeah, I'm trying to think of the last role that he was in where wasn't funny at all. I think it was maybe Gothica.
That's
the last
time
I can think
of
that he was in a movie where it was just a totally serious movie, and he wasn't being Tony Stark. Because in every movie since Iron Man, he's just been Tony Stark.
I mean, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and. I mean, he was a character actor in Tropic Thunder. And
he's... I love Robert Downey Jr., but he's very similar in his roles nowadays.
Yeah, but he is a great actor, and I think he could pull this off. Actually, the movie Gravity with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney, Robert Downey Jr. was selected to be the George Clooney character.
Oh, okay.
And he wanted to add a lot of his own personal touch to it, and they didn't want that.
Gotcha.
So he got off. I think it would have been a cool movie.
Yeah.
George Clooney did it well. But I think here, if him being the older guy, him not wanting to do it, maybe he could add like a very bit of that dark humor that he could have in him, him to do that. Because Detective Somerset was all serious all the time, and I think maybe to add like that a little dark humor in it could be really cool for a revamp.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I went with Idris Elba.
So, oh my God, Idris. I mean, I say yes to Idris Elba no matter what.
In pretty much anything.
Idris Elba can play the shark from Jaws and I would be happy.
Yeah, I think Idris Elba is one of the best actors out nowadays.
Right.
And has been for a long time. And I just feel like he would really nail... He's very similar in that vibe of just being older, wiser, and he can pull it off really well of being in control of the situation, uh-huh. having been around the block, a little worse for the wear emotionally, you know, got some baggage like Luther or something like that.
Right. Oh, man, that would be really cool.
Yeah, I would really enjoy that.
You're going to have to tell us who we should pick, seriously.
Yeah. We just cast two very different movies.
I mean, my first go around with this recasting was to have Kevin Hart play every role.
That's what you say about every
That's
movie.
What I say about every movie.
Or Cuba Gooding Jr.
Yeah, no, Cuba Gooding Jr. playing radio, playing another part. yes, indeed. But yeah, that's
episode
Mediocrity.
Episode 8.
Yeah, Mediocrity, episode 8. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at Mediocrity. Tell us what you think about Superman, the Beatles, and tell us who you would cast in a remake of 7. We'll be back next week with episode 9, Busta Rhyme.
Hopefully, old man Meggert will have his pussy foot healed by then.
I mean, it's bleeding right now. There's sand in it. We don't know what's going to go on.
Yeah.
But we miss you, Jeremy. We
wish you a speedy recovery.
Yes, we do. Until next time.